thing, even with a division of labour. Havers took on the job of sharing relevant fragments of information with the various parties who required them, if only for their peace of mind. So she paid a call upon the vicar of St. Lawrence Church to reassure him of Ian Druitt's innocence in all matters, and she arranged to meet Flora Bevans, not at her home, but at the site of an installation of an impressive array of newly planted urns, to give her the relief of knowing she had not been housing a paedophile beneath her roof. She found Brutus Castle and Ding Donaldson at home in Teamside. She took herself out to Much Wenlock to put Sergeant Jerry Gunderson into the picture of Ruddock's guilt. In the meantime, Linley journeyed to Birmingham, where he returned all of his son's possessions to Clive Druitt with the acknowledgment of that man's true assessment of his son's character, and from there he went to West Mercia Police Headquarters to meet with the Chief Constable and to put into his possession all the material he and Havers had been given to use during their investigation. C.C. Wyatt was understandably shell-shocked. The nature of the political and professional disaster he had on his hands was not going to fade from public memory any time soon. The public relations nightmare was only just beginning, and the judicial nightmare was on the horizon, ready to slouch in the direction of Hindlip as soon as the appropriate forces could be gathered. They had only a brief encounter with the Lomax family, and this was when Linley informed Rabir by mobile phone that her son Timothy had given his statement to the Shrewsbury team handling the events that had occurred in Teamside. She was gracious about everything, blaming no one, least of all the police, who were only doing what had to be done, Inspector. To his question about how the family were coping, she replied, "Just." On the following morning, then, they left Ludlow. Clive Druitt would come for his son's car, Linley informed the hotel. That being arranged, he and Havers set off for London. They went directly to Victoria Street. They had not been in the building for 5 minutes when the unwanted but nonetheless expected call came through from Judy McIntosh. They were wanted in the office of the Assistant Commissioner. "You're to go straight in," Judy McIntosh told them when they arrived in the Assistant Commissioner's office. She added, "No worries," as they passed by her desk. "Evidently the Home Office is pleased." Linley couldn't see how that could be the case, considering what they were looking at was everything from a police cover-up to murder. But it turned out that Clive Druitt had wanted his son proved to be just who his father claimed him to be, a decent man of God. That this had been proved, that an arrest of his killer had been made, that Ian's name had been cleared in every respect, that a prosecution would follow. These things were what his father had sought. As to what the news media made of everything, as to how the Met, the Home Office, and the West Mercia Police intended to handle what the news media made of everything, that was out of his hands, he told his MP. "The first head to roll will be Wyatt's," Hillier told them. "He made Freeman his DCC. He should have known, apparently, where that would lead. You did well, the two of you. You've Quentin Walker's thanks. I meant to pass them on." That, evidently, was what they'd been summoned to hear, after which they were dismissed. Or at least Linley was dismissed. As he and Havers got to their feet to depart the AC's office, Hillier told Havers to remain where she was. She looked alarmed and cast a glance of appeal in Linley's direction, but there was a limit to what he could do, and being told to leave Hillier's office defined it. He headed for the door, hearing only, "We need to have a different sort of conversation, Sergeant," from Hillier, as he opened it. Linley left them together. He didn't like the direction their conversation might take. Still, there was nothing for it but to return to Victoria Block, and there to wait for developments. He got only as far as the DCS's office when he arrived there, though. Dorothea Harriman called out, "You're wanted, Detective Inspector Linley," before he had the chance to pass by. She added, "Judy with an eye just rang. She wanted herself to have a heads up that you've been to see himself." She lowered her voice to just above a whisper in order to say, "Did he really ask Detective Sergeant Havers to stay at the end of your meeting?" "He was telling her he wanted to have a different sort of conversation when I left them," Linley replied. "That can't be good," Dorothea said. "Is that all you heard?"
"Lacking your talent?"
"Alas," Linley noted.
"Shall I go in?"
He indicated Isabel Ardrey's office.
"Oh, do, Dorothea said. "Word to the wise, though. She's not exactly chuffed you spoke with Hillier before seeing her."
Victoria, London. Isabel had expected some form of chain of command would be followed, Linley and Havers would report to her, she would report to Hillier, and Hillier would report to Clive Druitt's MP. What she had not expected was the short-circuiting that had occurred. That this had happened was irritating, but that Barbara Havers had been asked to remain with Hillier once Linley had been dismissed by the Assistant Commissioner was completely unnerving.
Gov?
Linley was courtesy itself, as usual.
Why have you reported to Hillier without speaking to me first?
She heard the level of annoyance in her demand and wished she'd schooled it. Too late now, she reckoned. Linley said in that maddeningly urbane way of his,
"We'd had less than 5 minutes in the building before we were called to his office, Gov.
And, as I understand it, the detective sergeant is still there."
Hillier asked her to remain.
"And his reaction to how everything's been handled?"
"No one's breaking out the champagne. A lawsuit filed by Clive Druitt's solicitors has been averted, but that's the extent of it. The amount of bollocksing up that's gone on since March has given journalists rather more political fodder than anyone's happy with."
"You're referring to me, I expect."
"I hadn't intended to. There's enough culpability to spread round. The chief constable, Patrick Wyatt, will have it worst, I dare say. Everything went on in his jurisdiction. So,"
Isabel cut in with, "he's talking to her about my drinking, isn't he? We both know why he asked her to remain. He rang me one night when I wasn't in proper form to speak with him. I thought it was Bob, or I wouldn't have answered."
Linley said nothing in reply to this. He did move to the door of her office and closed it quietly, however, so Isabel knew something was coming. She simply couldn't deal with more preaching from him, however. Nor could she deal with anyone, let alone Thomas Linley, pointing out that if anyone was being hoisted on a petard, she was that person and the petard was hers. She said,
"I'm finished, then. That's it, as you warned me, Tommy. As Bob warned me time and again. As I've tried and failed, actually, to warn myself."
Linley did that gentlemanly bit of examining his shoes to allow her to pull herself together, which she found rather maddening in that she was together. Of a single piece, of a single mind, fully aware and all the rest. He said, "May I sit?"
She said, "This doesn't need to be an extended conversation. I wanted to verify that Barbara Havers remained behind at Hillier's request. I've done that. We both know what it means. There's nothing more to be said."
"Isabel, if you'll listen to me..." "You failed from the first to—"
"I know! All right! There is no need for you to lord it over me, if you'll forgive the outrageous pun. I've driven myself to this destination, and that's that. I knew it the instant I opened the door to Dee Harriman's face and her bloody soup and sandwiches. She saw it all, and I've no doubt she returned with the tale and passed it round."
"Dee Harriman," Linley said, "is the embodiment of loyalty to this department, Isabel, and she's—"
"She's governed by self-interest as the rest of us are."
"That's entirely untrue. She's completely loyal, and to be frank, she's—"
"Oh, please, stop trying to protect her, not the only one.
If you've not worked out by now that—"
"Stop bloody preaching at me, stop bloody interrupting me."
They were face to face, and too close for her liking, so Isabel strode to her desk. She sat. She gestured rudely for him to do likewise. She said,
"May I say that you're as insufferable as you've been from the first? I know I've made a cock-up of my life, my career, my future, my relationship with my boys. Do you really think I need you to spell that out to me? I don't need that. Do you understand?"
"I do," he said. "But that doesn't prevent me from wanting you to see that—"
"When I said stop preaching, I meant stop preaching,
as I meant stop interrupting." His voice had grown louder. He was a man who so rarely lost his temper that it was almost a pleasure to push him in that direction, but her hands had now begun to shake. She had other concerns that were meant to be dealt with. He said, drawing in what Isabel reckoned was a steadying breath, "What I've been attempting to say to you is that you failed from the first to understand anything about Barbara Havers. Have that as you will, because I've given up attempting to make it clear to you that Barbara's a valuable member of the department. But I will have you know one thing, Isabel—"
"I'll have you bloody stop calling me
Isabel," he said again, and with far more emphasis than was strictly necessary. "The very last identity that Barbara Havers would take on is that of a common grass. That's neither who she is nor who she's ever been. As to you and your drinking, all of that is in your hands and no one else's. I suggest you leave Dee and Barbara out of whatever nonsense you've got running round inside your head." He rose and headed for the door.
She said, "I did not give you leave," but he waved her off. He left her. The door gaped open in his wake. Her hands were worse. She clenched them on the top of her desk. She clenched her jaw as well. She needed... After their conversation, she bloody needed. She swung her chair round and removed herself from the immediate vicinity of her desk, from the proximity to what she kept stowed in its bottom right drawer. She walked to the window. Blue sky rapidly clouding over, birds, the pavement, the street. She would not, she told herself, because she was the mistress of her life, as she always had been, only now it would be entirely different, wouldn't it? She was finished with more than one element of her existence, wasn't she? She would, she told herself. And she bloody well could. All this time, it had merely been a function of her brain. Her brain had been where the first falsehoods had come from, indicating to her that she needed something to help her relax, to help her sleep, to remove difficulties, to lighten the load. It was all about what she taught herself to believe that she needed when she didn't need it at all and never had done. Only, it had gone beyond that now. She saw that in her shaking hands, which would not stop shaking till the vodka entered her system. She wasn't at all shaking because of a fiction she'd learned to believe, whether that fiction dealt with relaxing, sleeping, removing difficulties, or anything else. She was at this point shaking because the physical need had finally taken over. What had been desire was now necessity. She couldn't bear it. She would have to. She approached her desk. Victoria Street, London. Barbara didn't know what to make of it when Hillier began their conversation with a comment upon the improvement in her appearance. She would have liked to think that, in blatant disregard of the possibility of being accused of sexual harassment, he was taking note of her svelte body, courtesy of more tap dancing than she'd ever wanted to do in her life. Problem was that she wore nothing svelte-inducing at the moment, if, indeed, one could induce svelte at all. Instead, she wore baggy trousers, a blouse in need of professional help in the ironing department, and brogues. Since these were, however so humble, an improvement over her past garments, she thanked Hillier carefully. She waited for more. It was short in coming. "I understand your overall comportment has undergone something of a transformation as well," Hillier went on. Barbara tried to look earnest. She hoped for the best. She did wish Linley were there, however. He was the only person she knew whose manners and breeding might run interference for her if it came down to Hillier's requesting an explanation for anything untoward she might have done. "I'm additionally pleased that your second involvement in Ludlow produced a better result than your first," he said. "What do you think went wrong on that initial visit?" Barbara's skin made an aha jump. She said, after a moment, to think about the various directions she could take and what each might cost her,
"The situation up there was dead complicated, sir. Elements of the investigation that looked absolutely one way turned out to be absolutely the other."
She hoped that this would suffice. It didn't. "Can you be more specific, since you were the only officer attending both Met investigations?"
"Oh, that. Well, the DCS and I didn't always see eye to eye, which happens, of course, and it could be that I wasn't... or that I didn't..."
His hawk-like eyes didn't move from her face. He said, "Do spit it out, Sergeant Havers."
"It's only that I wanted to do everything right, sir. I mean, I wanted to be certain I coloured inside the lines, if you know what I mean. That probably kept me quieter than usual."
"What about the DCS?"
"Sir? Colouring inside the lines? Outside the lines?
What about DCS Ardrey?"
Barbara didn't like the thinness of this ice at all. She said,
"I'm not sure what you mean, sir. Far as I know, and far as I've ever seen, the DCS does things straight by the book."
"Does she indeed?"
"Yes, sir. Absolutely. No doubt."
Barbara swallowed. Perhaps three affirmations were too many. Hillier watched her steadily. It was like a game of stare-down. He said, "I know there's no love lost between you and Detective Chief Inspector Ardrey, Sergeant Havers. And I don't want that to be an issue here."
"Oh, it's not, sir. I don't know what you might have heard. I'm not asking, but aside from Well, an audio that the PCSO in Ludlow sent me after the DCS had already told me the transcript was good enough, and then in my report, that's not under discussion.
Sir?
Hillier leaned across the desk, a move that Barbara found distinctly unnerving. It was an indication that this was going to be a just-us-boys moment between them, and what she knew beyond anything in her universe was that she and Hillier were not just-us-anything. He said,
"I'm going to ask you something directly, and I want you to answer me directly. Is that clear?"
Christ, was it ever. Barbara nodded.
"Good. It's my belief that the DCS was drinking to excess in Ludlow. It's my belief that she was altogether drunk on occasion. Considering everything that's gone on since her return from Shropshire, I want you to confirm her Ludlow behaviour before I decide what's to be done."
Barbara hadn't expected to be presented with such a moment of praise God and sing hallelujah. The opportunity before her would do more than merely benefit herself. It would benefit the entire department. She'd be able to drink and dine on it for years.
But
she frowned. She nodded. She hoped her expression telegraphed very deep thinking. And then she said,
"As far as I know, the DCS didn't drink at all, sir."
Hillier favoured her another hawk-like examination before he said, "Are you certain of that?" She knew his question had more than one meaning, but she also knew there was only one answer.
"As I ever could be," she said.
Victoria Street, London. Back at her desk, Barbara had little enough time before her phone rang. She was loath to answer it, but had no choice. It turned out to be Dorothea Harriman placing the call. As Barbara heard Dee's voice, she realized she should have expected to hear from her. Tonight was, after all, their regular tap-dancing lesson, and Dee would want to lay their plans. So after their hallos, Barbara sought to head her elsewhere.
"I'm begging off tonight, Dee. I need a rest."
"Tonight?" was Dee's unexpected reply.
"Oh, you mean Southall. No matter, I'll catch you up tomorrow. In fact, I'll come to you. If we move your kitchen table outside, we'll have room enough. Umaima's off the team, by the way. She's dropped the class entirely. Pregnant. There you have it. I've already adjusted the choreography. Dee. Anyway, that's not why I'm ringing. You're wanted. I've just been in Tower Block. It's the DCS asking for you."
And in a lower voice,
"Word to the wise. You might want to come at once. She looks feather-ruffled. And Detective Inspector Linley just had one of those closed-door meetings with her that never go well."
So Barbara went as ordered. She'd not been alone with Isabel Ardrey since just after Ludlow, and she would have preferred not to be alone with her now, but she saw no recourse. Ardrey was seated when Barbara walked into her office. Her only instructions were to close the door and to sit, neither of which sounded like particularly happy activities, but Barbara did as requested and found herself across an expanse of Ardrey's desk. What she noted first was that it was beyond its normal, orderly condition. It looked almost polished. What she noted second was Ardrey's stillness. She sat with her hands clasped, unsmiling as Barbara joined her.
"D.I. Linley tells me that you had a good result in Shropshire," she said. "Everything sewn up nicely, packaged and delivered to Mr. Druitt."
Barbara sensed the DCS's hostility. She wasn't at all sure how to go at this, so she said,
"Once we understood about the stole, Gov, its colour and all the rest. I mean, once you rang the inspector to tell him—" "Don't patronise me, Sergeant. I fully understand how much of an impediment I was to the investigation. I've been told you've spoken to the Assistant Commissioner privately, by the way."
Barbara said quickly,
"Right, I did, Gov. He wanted me to stay behind in order to ask me—" "Stop right there. At once."
Barbara gulped at Ardra's tone. Her sweat glands began working overtime. Ardrey opened one of the side drawers in her desk. From it, she took out what Barbara recognized immediately, the folder containing her transfer paperwork. Barbara said,
"But, Gov, Gov, please, can I just say, did I not tell you to stop?"
Ardrey snapped. She opened the folder. She pushed the paperwork across the desk.
"But I did every single... I don't... Please, take it,"
Ardrey said.
"But take it. I'm not asking you to sign the forms, Sergeant Havers. I'm telling you to take the forms. I'm giving them to you. Do you understand me? Do with them what you will."
"What?
Do you mean?"
"I mean take them,"
Barbara looked at the paperwork. She looked at Ardrey.
I don't... Gov, don't you want to know what Hillier wanted to... I do not... But if I take the paperwork... Do you mean that I can... What? Barbara, I meant what I said. I always mean what I say. Take the paperwork and do what you will with it.
Barbara reached for it. She kept her movements slow. It seemed to her that at any moment Ardrey would fall over laughing at how she duped the ignoramus sitting opposite her. But that didn't happen. Barbara eased the documents onto her lap. She waited for more. There was nothing. She got to her feet. She said,
Ta, Gov.
And when Ardrey nodded, she headed for the door. But there she paused and said,
Can I ask, did the inspector...
This has nothing to do with Inspector Linley, Ardrey said.
This, just now, is between the two of us alone.
Victoria Street, London. When the call from the Assistant Commissioner came, Isabel was ready for it. She'd made the necessary arrangements, and she'd spoken to Bob. Her former husband had given her an informal reassurance and a formal blessing, both of which she was going to have to depend upon, since there was nothing put into writing. Having finished up what needed to be finished up then, what had remained was waiting for the phone to ring with Judy McIntosh on the line, telling her that Hillier was ready to see her. She gathered her belongings, chagrined by the paucity of them. They consisted of a photo of the twins, a photo of herself with the twins, a coffee cup and 10 airline bottles of vodka. Everything fit easily into her briefcase, which in other circumstances would have held reports on activities from the various investigators under her command. She took up her shoulder bag as well and headed for the doorway. There she paused for a final look. Odd, she thought. It was only a room in a building, wasn't it? She'd given it, and rooms exactly like it, too much significance over too many years. She switched off the overhead lights, and she closed the door. She was lucky in that the hour was late, and consequently there was no one nearby to see her. She could do without questions at the moment. In Tower Block she went to Hillier's office, where the door stood open in anticipation of her arrival. Judy McIntosh had left for the day, and Isabel could see Hillier sitting at his desk waiting for her. She was struck by the similarity between his position behind the desk and what had been her position behind the desk when she had her brief meeting with Sergeant Havers. Like her, Hillier sat with hands folded. Unlike her, he played with a pencil between his fingers. When she entered, he told her to sit. She told him that she preferred to stand. He nodded. He did not rise to join her. She said to him,
I wish I could tell you that meetings alone would be enough, sir. If I believed that, I would go to them daily, twice daily if necessary. I've never been to one, although I've thought about it now and again. But what I know from where I am just now, and what it's done to me physically, I'm going to need a supervised withdrawal. I mean a medically supervised withdrawal. I found a program. They say 6 weeks. They can take me at once.
Where? He asked her.
Isle of Wight. It's a clinic and a recovery center. First is detox, and then... Well, then there's recovery. They expect detox will take a week.
And recovery?
A lifetime. What I mean is that no one actually recovers. One just learns the skills to cope.
With?
The need first, and what drives the need second. So after detox, which deals with the physical part of it, there are 5 weeks of meetings and analyses and whatnot. After that, then, there are daily meetings, morning, afternoon, night. It doesn't matter. They're everywhere in London, and one can go to as many as one wishes.
Hillier nodded. He set the pencil to one side, but he kept his fingers on it, and with one hand he rolled it against the top of his desk. She said,
I'd like to swear to you that I can do this, sir. I'd like to tell you there will never be another occurrence, but the truth is, I don't know that.
And is that meant to set my mind at rest?
It's only to tell you what I understand just at this moment.
She did sit, then. She put her briefcase on the floor, but she kept her shoulder bag on her lap.
I've told myself before now that I can stop. I've done it, too. A month here, 2 months there, just to prove to myself that it doesn't own me. But the reality is that it's owned me for years.
He nodded again. She hadn't expected praise from the man, especially as she wasn't owed any, but she wanted something from him. And wasn't it a howling good joke that what she wanted from David Hillier was a form of humanity that she herself
had been incapable of showing anyone for more years than she wanted to think about. It would be a humanity that demonstrated understanding, or compassion, or forgiveness, or anything save the silence that now stretched between them. She said, "I'm hoping for a leave of absence, sir. If I knew my job was waiting for me at the end of all this, it's that I'd have a light at the end of the tunnel. That wouldn't make it easier. Nothing about this is going to be easy. But it would give me, perhaps, a goal."
He rose. He walked to his bank of windows. June was coming fast upon them with its notoriously unpredictable weather, and the rain had begun to fall. Just now it speckled the windows. Another few minutes and it would streak them. Without turning, Hillier said, "I wouldn't have given you the position of DCS had Linley been willing to take it on. You know that, don't you?"
"I do, sir."
"I also wouldn't have given you the position had I not believed you can do the job. I still believe that, by the way. Not as you are now, but as you might be." Isabel said nothing. She was gratified to hear what he'd said, but he hadn't said it all, and so she waited. He turned from the window and took his time about observing her, about returning to his desk, about sitting and folding his hands again. "Granted," he finally said. "Conquer your demons first, and then you and I will talk about what comes next for you."
"Thank you, sir."
"When do you leave?"
"Now."
"Then Godspeed."
She offered him the only kind of smile she could manage, which was faltering at best. She picked up her briefcase, bid him farewell, and walked to the doorway, where his words stopped her.
"Sergeant Havers said nothing, by the way. You ought to know that. I did ask her, but she wouldn't do it. Throw you to the wolves, I mean. She didn't even venture near it."
"Tommy said she wouldn't," she replied.
And then because it was the truth, and she owed the truth to everyone.
"She's a good officer, sir. Bloody infuriating most of the time, admittedly, but very good all the same."
Hillier sighed. "Would that political life were not so difficult, eh?"
"Sir?"
"How I wish she were completely inept, but that will never be the case. Nor will it be the case for Linley. And even on his best days, he's only marginally less infuriating than Havers."
She smiled then, and she found it easy.
As did she find her final words to Hillier.
"I'd never disagree with that, sir. But it has to be said, they get the job done."
6th July. Southall, London.
"You aren't actually expecting Barbara to forgive you for this, are you?"
Deirdre asked him.
"I know very well she told you and everyone else that this event was not to be attended by anyone who knows her."
"Barbara Havers will thank me in the long run. In the short term she'll be furious, of course, but given time all that will change."
"You're mad," Deirdre noted.
"The wind, hawks, hand saws, and all the rest," was his reply. He cast a look at her in the passenger seat of the Healy Elliot. "I'm quite glad you're back in London, Deirdre." She hadn't been gone as long this time round, but during the last 6 weeks she'd been in and out of town, down to Cornwall and back again, in a series of journeys that had eaten up virtually all of her free time. He'd protested when she would hear nothing of his accompanying her. This was her family, not his, she explained, so this was her problem as well. Her birth mother had died. The miracle cure the woman hoped for denied her, as it was denied so many others in her condition. The death had been a long one, made excruciating not only by her beliefs, but also by the conditions in which she, her husband, and their two other adult children lived. Towards the end she had still refused to be taken to hospital, or for that matter, to hospice. God would serve the purpose of handing her the cure she was intent upon. Once the poor woman had passed, the issue had become Deirdre's siblings and her father, and the question of what to do with them, for them, and about them. Here, too, Deirdre declined Linley's assistance in any form it might take. To his protest of, "What are we to each other, then, you and I?" she replied,
"What I must do bears no relationship to you and me, to us, to the whatever it is we share. As I don't intrude upon your family, Tommy, I ask you not to intrude upon mine."
But of course he wanted her to intrude upon his family. Indeed, he'd been quite forthright in the matter of the two of them showing their faces at Hounslow, so that she might be introduced to his brother, sister, mother and niece. Deirdre had dodged that bullet for quite long enough.
He had assumed that at some point she would actually want to come to his family's home, because she had lost her own small cottage in Polcare Cove once she made the decision that Goran and Gwinda Udi, the adult twins who were her siblings, would leave the caravan that their father refused to abandon, believing against years of evidence to the contrary that he could achieve riches through the expedient of tin streaming. They would take up permanent residence in their elder sister's isolated retreat, a small cottage that had been Deirdre's off-duty refuge during her employment at Bristol's zoo. As he knew, the cottage was large enough, she'd told Linley, a bedroom for each of the twins, and they could share the bathroom. To Linley's, "But what about you, Deirdre? I know what the cottage means to you," she had replied with, "I can sleep on the sofa when I want to go down." "That won't do for a peaceful retreat."
"Perhaps not. We'll see. But I can't leave them in that wretched caravan. And this is the only solution I've been able to come up with. It's not likely they'd want to come to town."
"But do they actually want to move from the caravan?"
"They're frightened, of course. What else would they be just now? There they've been in that horrible place since they were 18 years old, after a placement even worse than living with our parents. They deserve better. The cottage offers them that. I'm happy to provide it."
"I hate to see you,
Tommy. Our lives, yours and mine, have been too different for you ever to be able to understand."
"That's not altogether fair."
"Isn't it? Consider being taken from your parents. Consider ending up in Falmouth, with a wonderful home and wonderful family and privileges you never expected to have. Consider discovering that what you were given is exactly what your siblings were not given in the homes where they were sent. And then consider how you would feel upon learning that."
"I understand."
"How can you? You haven't lived it, so you can't know it. They, Goran and Gwinda, were robbed of every possibility in life, and I want that to be over for them. Call it guilt or whatever you'd like, but I won't leave them in a situation that means the rest of their lives will be as horrible as the first part of their lives has been."
He hated how her words affected him, with their intimation of impossibility. This was a discussion between them that could go round and round for hours. He knew it was a moment when it was best to let the subject die. But although he was adept doing that much, he was without a single talent when it came to burying the corpse. Eventually he told himself that it could all be a good thing, since, despite sleeping on the floor of her London flat for months on end while she renovated it, it wasn't likely that Deirdre would be happy sleeping on the sofa in her own cottage when she went to Cornwall for a break from London. This meant, at the end of the day, that there was every chance she would at last consent to a Cornish retreat somewhat larger than the one she was used to. His family home near Lamorna Cove. Havers would, of course, say, "I wouldn't wager any money on that, Inspector." But then that was Havers in a nutshell. No one would ever accuse the woman of over-sanguinity. As if reading his mind regarding Havers, Deirdre said,
"This could all work out very badly, you know."
He recognized her change of subject and lied to her blithely. "It could. I do know that." But he didn't see how that was truly possible. He was certain that his plan would have a brilliant conclusion that Havers would thank him for in the end.
"I'm glad to hear that. But really, Tommy, did everyone have to be in on this?"
"It seemed less awkward that way," he told her. "Beyond that, we do rather need Winston as a visual distraction, don't we?"
"But his parents as well?"
"That was something I could not have stopped had I tried. Winston keeps no secrets from his parents, and evidently Barbara Havers in tap shoes promised to be as entertaining as was Barbara Havers taking a cooking lesson from Alison Carter."
"And the others?"
"Others? Do you mean Denton?"
"Stop acting innocent. I mean Denton, Simon, Deborah, Philip Hale and his wife. Who else, Tommy?"
"I believe Dorothea's family are going, but you can't hold me responsible for that."
"You're quite impossible," was her conclusion. "I'd no idea you had such a naughty streak in you."
The dance recital was to be not far from where the lessons themselves were given. A community centre had provided its hall for the event. Havers, naturally, had been mute on the subject. Dorothea, on the other hand, was happy to direct him to the World Wide Web, where he gleaned every scrap of information she had regarding place, time, and number of tap routines they could expect to delight them. And delighted they no doubt would be, he thought. No one was as ready as he to watch Barbara and Dorothea hoof their way into history. Southall, London. Barbara was beside herself.
Not only had their bit been relegated to what was euphemistically being called Act Two, it had also been placed as the penultimate performance of the event. This meant that her plan to escape the community centre within an hour of arriving at the community centre was completely scotched. What was worse, she'd spied Winston and Carter in the crowd when she'd peeked from backstage. It was difficult to miss him, as he was 6'5", and neither of his parents, both of whom were also apparently going to be witnesses to her humiliation, was much shorter. That Winston had shown up was bad enough. No, that Winston had shown up was maddening enough, but then Barbara saw Simon St. James and his wife Deborah, long-time friends of Linley, and was that Charlie Denton taking a seat near the aisle at the side of... That wasn't Deborah's father, was it, half-hidden by three women wearing burkas? At the sight of them, Barbara went from irritation with Linley to jealousy of the three black-clad women. A large bedsheet of any colour on her own body wouldn't have gone down half bad, anything rather than having to be seen in the costumes Dorothea had designed. She had wanted Roaring Twenties at first. To hear her tell it, she'd had her heart set on the Roaring Twenties, and she declared herself devastated when she'd been told that Cole Porter's music was not part of that period of time. "Think 30s," Cass had informed her. "Art Deco, and all the rest." So Dorothea had moved from flapper dresses to sailor suits. Barbara couldn't see this as much of an improvement, but at least she wouldn't have to show her legs. They'd practiced and practiced since Barbara's return from Shropshire. Dorothea had declared that doing the steps properly was all about muscle memory, and the way to achieve muscles with memory was to force those muscles into repeating the same action until they automatically reacted to the music as they'd been taught to. "It's exactly like riding a bicycle," Dorothea said. "Another activity I never intend to perform in front of an audience," had been Barbara's reply. But now, here she was. Having endured Act One, the interval, and now practically all of Act Two, the time was nigh. The next hapless group of dancers were about to take to the stage. Barbara and Dorothea were to follow. They stood ready, in their sailor suits, their sailor hats, with walking sticks in their hands. Barbara had tried to talk Dee out of the walking sticks, as they didn't seem sailorly to her. What sailor went shipboard with a walking stick anyway? But they were an important part of the overall effect, don't you see? According to Dorothea. Barbara didn't see, but what was the point of fighting this any longer? At least, she told herself, she wasn't a part of the group of eight assembling, fully if oddly costumed, on the stage in what looked vaguely like a deflating life raft, but was supposed to be an enormous bowl. Someone, potentially more clueless than talented, had come up with the idea of fruit coming to life to the tune of Hooray for Hollywood. Barbara would have felt sorry for the pineapple had she only possessed the emotional reserves required to feel sorry for someone other than herself. When the audience cheered enthusiastically at the conclusion of the fruit bowl number, and this despite the fact that the melon and the banana crashed into each other and fell to the floor midway through, Dorothea was fast upon her. She clapped her hands, beamed, and cried, "This is it! It's what we've been working towards!" which made Barbara want to tell her that she herself had been working towards breaking an ankle with only limited success. She'd managed to come up with an ingrown toenail, but that was it. "We're going to be brilliant!" Dorothea exclaimed. "Did you tell Winston where this was happening?" Barbara demanded. Dorothea slapped her hand against her chest, saying, "What? Is Detective Sergeant Incarter here? Why would I tell him, or anyone, to ensure applause, I reckon? Detective Sergeant Havers, we had, have, and will have no need of bringing our own supporters to this event. We're going to be a sensation." "I'm taking note that you didn't answer the question." "What question?" "The one asking if you told Winston where this stellar event was taking place." Dorothea had bent to retie her tap shoes. She rose to say, "He probably learned from the detective inspector." "What?" Dorothea clapped her hand over her mouth. She went on with, "How could I not at least give Detective Inspector Linley a hint when he asked, especially when he said he meant to bring along a surprise for you? Don't you like surprises? A surprise in the persons of Winston and Carter, his parents, and, I wager, everyone D.I. Linley knows, is not something I've been burning for. You're lucky I don't take off these shoes and throw them at you, Dee. But I didn't tell him. I mentioned the website, but that's all. I swear it. I told him that he'd have to do everything else on his own." "Oh, he's managed that all right," Barbara said. "You're being very silly," Dorothea said.
and then, "Ah, there's our cue. Time to Cincinnati."
Which was what they did, with Barbara asking herself how bad could it be to have her colleagues watch her make a fool of herself. They'd already seen her do so in other situations. What was one more? A cheer went up as she and Dorothea Cincinnati'd their way onto the stage to Cole Porter. That their costumes had nothing whatsoever to do with the lyrics appeared to make no difference to anyone. Someone started a chant of Barbara, Barbara, and while she wasn't about to embrace this as a sign of approbation, at least she was confident that what her associates knew about tap dancing could fill a teaspoon. If she made errors, they would be clueless. All she had to do was remain upright and act as if everything she did was part of the show. It all went as it went. Not entirely well, not entirely disastrous. She managed to remember the order of the opening bit only once, confusing a riffle with a scuffle. Smiling through it all was a challenge, since doing that while also saying riff, jump, shim-sham, cramp roll was more than she could consistently manage. So instead of beaming at the audience as Dorothea was managing to do, she accomplished a glance or three in that general direction as they went along. But then the glue of her determination gave way. Her steps faltered. Her steps failed. She saw who was sitting next to Charlie Denton. And it was not the father of Deborah St. James. She Cincinnati'd directly off the stage. Southall, London. There were no dressing rooms. She'd had to wear the bloody sailor suit to the event. Only the pieces of fruit had not come already in costume, since they could don their various bits of gear directly over their street clothing. As for the rest of them, there would be no way that they could leave the premises incognito. So she had to get away. She had to do it quickly. She didn't stop to wonder at the why of this. She was operating on rote fight or flight, and she was choosing flight. Once backstage, she elbowed her way through a Fred and Ginger and a group of children wearing miniature top hats and tails. She heard Kaz behind her saying, "What is it?" But she didn't pause. He could think it was delayed stage fright coming at her at a gala, or a planned revenge against Dorothea for getting her involved in this insanity in the first place. He could think she'd twisted an ankle, been struck by food poisoning, or been hit with a visitation of the plague. It didn't matter. Nor did it matter that Dorothea was left on the stage to complete the number and to pretend it was all part of the show, that her partner had executed a hasty removal of herself. Of course, when it came to the end, and Barbara Havers did not show up to receive her share of the applause, it would look strange. But she didn't care how it looked. She merely cared about absenting herself at once. The worst was, she didn't know why she was doing so. The worst was, she didn't know what it meant that an Italian detective called Salvatore Lobianco was actually in the audience. He had to have been brought there by D.I. Linley, and the absolutely bloody worst of this was, she did not understand why Linley would seek to humiliate her in such a fashion. She heard him calling her name as she approached her Minnie. He was no fool, Linley. He might not have known a thing about tapping, but he knew a great deal about reading people. So he would have read her expression, followed by Dorothea's expression, and he would have put those pieces together with the kind of speed for which he was known. She whirled on him. "Why did you?" she shouted. "Did you think I'd be chuffed, amused, thrilled to bits? I asked you not to come. I told you not to come. And not only did you decide to come anyway, you also decided to invite Salvatore, didn't you? And the rest of them as well. Simon, Deborah, Charlie, whoever else. Winston. Yes, Winston, and his mum and his dad. What about my neighbours? Did you try them as well?" He raised his hands in a defensive gesture, so she knew she'd got through to him at last. He said, "Barbara, stop. Listen."
"I won't," she cried. "I bloody well won't. Do you think you know what's best for me, like everyone else? Well, you don't, Inspector. You've just made me into a bloody joke in front of my colleagues, in front of friends, in front of—"
She couldn't say the rest. She found herself so far beyond anger that she didn't even know the name for what she was feeling. "I didn't invite Salvatore," Linley said. And then, after a moment of glancing back at the building where the dancing continued, "No, that's not entirely true. I did invite him, but not to travel all the way here from Italy. He was coming here anyway. He's about to begin an English course."
"An English course? What's he want with a bloody English course?"
"I've no idea. You might want to ask him.
I invited him to stay with me, and once it was clear that he'd be here on this precise day...
You thought it was a perfect time to make me a laughingstock. That's why you brought him and everyone else.
I can't even begin to understand how you managed to arrive at that conclusion. Why in God's name would I ever want to make you a laughingstock?
Because that's what I am,
she cried, with a sudden knowledge of a truth she'd lived with and avoided for years.
Because that's what I'll always be.
You can't possibly mean that.
Just look at me. Think about what it's like to be who I am and where I've come from and how it feels to know that I've no chance ever to...
She forced herself to stop because she knew she would begin to weep if she didn't, and there was simply no way on earth, in heaven or in hell, that she intended to begin weeping in the car park of a Southall community centre in front of Thomas Linley while dressed in a sailor costume. "You come with me at once," Linley said. His voice had altered, not to the voice, but to something that had an edge of roughness to it. When she didn't move, he said, "I said come with me. I'm giving you an order."
"And if I bloody will decide to refuse?"
she said with a sneer. "I wouldn't take that option if I were you." That said, he turned. He did not look back to see if she was following him. She gave thought to disobeying his order, but there had been a flinty quality to his voice that suggested she might not want to do that. So she trudged in his wake. By the time they got back inside, the curtain calls had begun. One by one, the dancing acts took the stage to applause and cheers from their families, friends, and supporters. Barbara had a feeling about what was coming, so she was not surprised when Linley said to her, "When Dorothea comes out on the stage, you will join her, and you won't be doing it for yourself. You will be doing it for her, because she's fond of you. As are we all, by the way, but I can see now is not the moment to argue that point with you."
"I can't go—"
"You damn well can, and you damn well will," Linley said. "Use the centre aisle to do it, and if you don't make the entire thing look intentional, you will be answering to me. Is that quite clear, Sergeant?" She was stupefied. She wanted to say, "How bloody dare you act in the right when you bloody well know you are in the wrong?" She wanted to say, "Don't you bloody throw your lordshipness at me?" She wanted to say, "You don't know me, you don't know anything, you don't know what's inside me, and you've never known." Only, that wasn't the reality, was it? That had never been the reality. Thomas Linley knew more than anyone ever gave him credit for, and what he knew better than anything else was the nature of her struggle. And she knew he knew this, for the simple reason that he never mentioned it, ever, even now. He spared her that. He had always done so. Dorothea emerged from the wings, then. The crowd applauded. She smiled prettily, but it had to be said she looked tentative about it, which wasn't like Dorothea at all. Linley said, "Go," and Barbara understood that she could not hesitate. She charged up the aisle. She leapt onto the stage with such momentum that she lost her balance. She fell and slid in Dorothea's direction, ending up at Dorothea's feet. And just as Linley had instructed her to do, she made even that look like part of the show. This is Simon Vance. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Punishment She Deserves by Elizabeth George. This program was produced by Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright 2018 by Susan Elizabeth George. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.